Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is side one of For the Record program number 541, titled Leaks. This is being recorded on February 12th of the year 2005. At the end of this side, I'm going to mention a number of websites that people can utilize in order to flesh out their understanding of what they hear on this broadcast. And increasingly, I think that people who are only listening to the audio files are missing an awful lot of the For the Record / Dave Emery experience, because increasingly there's a lot of supplemental information, printed information in particular, on some of these websites. The title of the broadcast, Leaks, alludes to, or doesn't allude to, it's a direct reference to a number of leaks that have been coming out concerning some of the things that had been going on behind the scenes and out of the spotlight of public awareness. There have been a number of, at least to a certain extent, damning disclosures concerning failures or deliberate malfeasance on the part of the Bush administration and its pursuit of various things, from the Iraqi invasion to the, quote, war on terror, unquote. I do not share the view that is popular in certain circles that, in fact, there is no war. There is a very real war, and unfortunately, I think at this stage of the game, we are in all probability going to lose, due in no small measure, to a fifth column in this country. One of the reasons that I spent the time that I did late last year and early this year writing descriptions for the large number of old anti-fascist books that are on the web is I realized at a certain point, and when I say on the web, I mean on the Spitfire website, at a certain point, in order to understand what's going on today, one must have something of an understanding of the past history of fascism, and in particular, what a fifth column movement is. And I do hope the listeners will take advantage of some of those books in order to flesh out their understanding. I believe that there is something akin to what in certain respects could be viewed as a civil war within the national security establishment of this country and also within the combined British and American national security establishments. There are elements, very significant elements, that are not at all pleased with what the Bush administration has been doing, and to a certain extent what it has been doing in conjunction with the United Kingdom. And a lot of the disclosures that have been coming out appear to have been a deliberate attempt on the part of people within the military and the intelligence community to fight back against what they perceive as the extreme damage, and I believe their perceptions are accurate, the tremendous damage that the Bush administration has done to this country. We're going to be taking a look at something of at the nature of this civil war. I think there are a number of divides within the national security establishment, and many of the leaks that are coming out about how the Bush administration has, the way it cooked intelligence or cherry-picked intelligence in order to go ahead with the Iraq invasion, some of the leaks about the failure to obtain warrants for wiretapping, some of the leaks about major gaffes in the Bush administration's pursuit of the war on terror. Many of these are being deliberately leaked in order to embarrass the Bush administration, in my opinion. I think that also some of the leaks are being conducted by people who are being precipitated by people who are sincerely concerned about some of the abuses. But as we're going to see, particularly with regard to the NSA spying scandal, to a certain extent what we're seeing is something of a tempest in a teapot. There has been a lot of flap about how President Bush authorized the NSA to go ahead and begin spying on terror suspects without a warrant. Well, as we're going to see, stuff like that has been absolutely routine for a long time. So the question is, with such warrantless wiretapping literally being standard operating procedure, why are we suddenly hearing this great flap about this? And I believe that in part at least, That leak represents, again, something of a counterattack by elements within the national security establishment that do not like the way Bush has abused the intelligence community and a whole lot of other things during the course of his time in office. As we're going to see later on in the broadcast, too, I think that there is another reason for the flap about the wiretaps. Some of the people, as we're going to see when we examine a San Francisco Chronicle article later on in the broadcast, the flap about the NSA warrantless spying has melded some strange bedfellows. We're seeing people, at least in some cases of relatively liberal persuasion, like the ACLU, making common cause with people and elements like Grover Norquist. And in this case, I don't think, at least vis-a-vis Grover Norquist's lobbying against warrantless wiretapping, I don't think that we're seeing a disenchantment on the part of Grover Norquist with the Bush administration's policies so much as we are seeing an awareness on the part of Grover Norquist that potentially at least, if the truth concerning his deliberate representation of some of the most heinous terrorists were to come out, basically he would be seen for what he is, somebody who, for all intents and purposes, is an accessory, certainly after the fact, perhaps even before the fact, to September 11th. Because as we've seen in many broadcasts, and as we're going to review again this evening, Grover Norquist and his Islamic Institute have quite literally run PR interference for Muslim Brotherhood elements associated with the Al-Taqwa Milieu, Hamas, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, and Al-Qaeda. And indeed, if in fact the truth concerning Grover Norquist's dealings were ever to be properly publicized and properly utilized, Grover Norquist would certainly go to prison and possibly even face execution for high treason. So I think when we see Grover Norquist saying he's shocked that the NSA is conducting warrantless wiretapping, we're seeing some rather concrete self-interest, because Grover Norquist, at least potentially, has a great deal to lose, because Grover Norquist has been the lobbyist for and a PR interference man for some of the worst terrorists on Earth, and in the case of people like Sami Al-Arian, people allied with the Bush administration as well, and also people who have been oozed over by the so-called progressive sector. We're going to ruminate about Grover Norquist and his representation of terrorists later on in the program, but we're going to begin by taking a look at a very thoughtful column that appeared in the Financial Times of London on Monday, January 9th of 2006. This article talks about the Watergate scandal, and it touches ever so obliquely on one of the fundamentals of Watergate, although this column talks about Mark Felt, a deputy director of the FBI who was identified by Bob Woodward as, quote, deep throat, unquote. It has been common knowledge, and I've spoken about this in many broadcasts, that in fact elements of the intelligence community deliberately set up Richard Nixon in Watergate. There were a variety of things that Nixon had done to upset elements of the intelligence community. His Houston plan, designed to subsume all intelligence functions into one super agency, thereby threatening the bureaucratic domain of institutions like the CIA, that caused Nixon to run afoul of the intelligence community. His rapprochement with China alienated the China lobby, and indeed his policies of detente with the former Soviet Union alienated much of the far right. As noted in the column I'm about to read, the popular history of Watergate has it that it was a manifestation of true democratic institutions acting through a quote free press, unquote. Yeah, but nah, that isn't what it was. Rather, it was elements of the intelligence community deliberately pulling the rug out from under Richard Nixon. There are indications that, in fact, elements of the intelligence community are doing, or at least attempting, to do the same thing to George Bush. Whether or not they are able to be successful remains to be seen. I would not hold my breath for an impeachment proceeding against George Bush, certainly not with a Republican-controlled Congress. and a Republican-controlled court system. I don't think we're likely to be seeing that. But who knows? As President Eisenhower once said, no kidding, I know I speak for the vast majority of Americans when I say the future lies ahead. An actual quote from President Eisenhower, so we'll see what develops. First item up, from the Financial Times of Monday, January 9th of 2006, a column by Edward Alden titled, Echoes of Nixon as the Spooks Take Their Revenge. And this article will sort of sound the theme for the broadcast, namely that many of the leaks that are coming into public view are deliberate attempts by elements of the intelligence community to fight back against the Bush administration for their abuses of various things, including and especially the intelligence services themselves. This column by Edward Alden reads, in the standard history of Watergate, it was an intrepid press, the courts, and Congress that brought down President Richard Nixon. But last year's revelation that Bob Woodward's legendary deep throat source was in fact the deputy director of the FBI offers another interpretation. By Woodward's own account, Mark Felt was not simply one important source for the Washington Post reporting. He had access to every facet of the Justice Department's Watergate investigation and, angered over what he saw as White House abuse of his beloved FBI, provided the Post with a roadmap to uncover the crimes. Nixon, it seems, was not so paranoid when he claimed that the Washington establishment, the professional bureaucracy and its supporters, was out to get him. President George W. Bush has his own establishment problem, as reporter James Risen's new book, State of War, makes clear. Like Woodward before him, Risen has been on the receiving end of leaks from career national security officials who are deeply unhappy with the current administration. Mr. Bush declared war on the bureaucracy after September 11, 2001, and it is fighting back. Risen and his New York Times colleague Eric Lichtblau revealed last month that Mr. Bush secretly authorized the National Security Agency to intercept telephone and email communications on U.S. soil, an explosive story that has sparked a national debate over presidential powers. The anonymous sources, who are now the target of a Bush administration leak investigation, were nearly a dozen current and former government officials. They are, like Felt, almost certainly from the organizations that have felt most under siege by the Bush White House, the CIA, the uniformed military, and the state and justice departments. The president has paid a high price for alienating these institutions. The mishandling of post-invasion Iraq, which has dogged his presidency ever since, came about largely because State Department experts were excluded from post-war planning. It was an Army investigation that uncovered the Abu Ghraib abuses and military lawyers who have most aggressively challenged the administration's mistreatment of detainees. And a career Justice Department official, James Comey, former Deputy Attorney General, appointed Patrick Fitzgerald, the bulldog prosecutor who indicted Vice President Dick Cheney's chief of staff on perjury charges in the CIA leak investigation. By the way, parenthetically, Libby is now indicating that unnamed superiors, or at least to date, unnamed superiors, were responsible for leaking the information to him. Continuing, Mr. Comey also tried unsuccessfully to curb the NSA spying program. But the biggest reckoning may come at the hands of the CIA, which has been decimated by defections during the Bush years. Quote, no other institution failed in its mission as completely during the Bush years as did the CIA, he writes. Instead of defending his professional analysts and agents, Risen argues former Director George Tenet sought to ingratiate himself with the president by providing him with exactly what he wanted, an intelligence pretext for war with Iraq. The professionals have fought back, revealing more and more of how the intelligence was manipulated. Using his sources inside the agency, Risen reveals that agency officials actually made serious attempts to get Iraq right. For instance, the agency tracked down some 30 overseas relatives of Iraqi scientists thought to be involved with weapons of mass destruction. The relatives agreed to go to Iraq and try to have private conversations with those scientists. All came back with the same report. Saddam Hussein's WMD programs had been shut down since the end of the first Gulf War. But none of it ever made its way out of the bowels of the agency. Instead, top administration officials chose to believe Iraqi exiles such as the infamous Curveball and his claims about mobile bioweapons labs cruising the Iraqi desert, despite repeated warnings from senior CIA officials that he was almost certainly a fabricator. The book's other chapters are filled with similar stories from disgruntled spooks who believe the war on terrorism has been badly mishandled from the outset. Such criticisms will not surprise the agency's many neoconservative detractors, who see it as too hidebound by timidity and bureaucratic inertia to operate in a war in which the old rule books no longer apply. Risen acknowledges the national security bureaucracy is, quote, maddeningly slow, lacks creativity, and is risk-averse, unquote, but it has, he writes, one great virtue, quote, it tends to weed out really stupid or dangerous ideas, unethical and even immoral ideas, ideas that could get people killed, unquote. Well, we'll see what happens, because when one turns to the subject of Grover Norquist, the people he represents, and the absolutely decisive position of power that he holds in Washington, D.C., well, let's just say we don't see too much being weeded out vis-a-vis Grover Norquist. We'll talk more about that later. What we're going to do now is we're going to review a section of a book that we've used many times on this program. That book is The Secret War Against the Jews, co-authored by John Loftus and Mark Ahrens. The book is subtitled How Western Espionage Betrayed the Jewish People. And specifically, what we're going to be taking a look at is something that places the NSA warrantless wiretapping flap in perspective, as we're going to see, and as we've seen in our past discussions of this, of the relationship between the NSA and the GCHQ of the United Kingdom. In fact, warrantless wiretapping has been going on as literally standard operating procedure for more than half a century, and specifically the United States and the United Kingdom, as well as related members of the British Commonwealth, such as Canada and Australia, have been conducting warrantless and widespread electronic surveillance, including wiretapping, for each other in each other's native countries for decades. Specifically, although it may be technically illegal for NSA or other U.S. intelligence agencies to conduct warrantless wiretapping, it isn't illegal for British agents to conduct warrantless wiretapping on Americans, and it isn't illegal for Americans to be conducting warrantless wiretapping on British citizens. And so basically, for decades, that is exactly what has happened. If the U.S. wants to monitor somebody and doesn't want to go through the niceties required to get official sanction, they simply turn to the British, who then gather the requisite information and pass it along. We do the same thing for the British. Now, in the discussion which is to follow, this is not necessarily to advance a ringing endorsement of this particular arrangement, but it is rather to give us some perspective, because as we have seen in our past discussions of this dynamic, and as we're going to see in our review of this dynamic, warrantless wiretapping has literally been business as usual. So why are we suddenly seeing all these people going there shocked to learn that there is gambling going on in this establishment, of course, parroting the famous words of Louis Renault, the police chief in Casablanca. And again, I think in that Edward Alden column, we are seeing the reason. Basically, there are elements within the national security establishment, within the military intelligence community and State Department, who are fighting back against the Bush administration's abuses. And also there are elements in the United Kingdom, I think, that are deeply alienated from the Bush administration, and they too are bucking an even more formidable barrier to disclosure, the British Official Secrets Act. And we're seeing things like the Downing Street memo coming out, and as we're going to see, there's been another damaging disclosure in the United Kingdom about the Bush administration and its road to war. But what we're about to do is to review the NSA-GCHQ liaison, and we're going to see just how extensive the warrantless electronic surveillance programs have been, and how extensive they have been for a long period of time, more than half a century. This, again, in order to understand why some questions should be asked about why we're seeing all of these disclosures. Warrantless wiretapping is business as usual. the reason why we're seeing this flap about it is in all probability due to a Watergate-like dynamic. There are elements in the intelligence community who are using this in order to basically strike back at the Bush administration for what it's done. Turning now to The Secret War Against the Jews by John Loftus and Mark Ahrens. By the way, the reference to old spies here is to a group of veteran intelligence agents from the retired intelligence agents from the U.S., the United Kingdom, the former Soviet Union, and Israel, who've given the authors a great deal of information about some of the past abuses of the intelligence community. One of the things that we're going to see here, by the way, is the fact that due to a number of elements of paranoia within the intelligence community, any Jew who is supportive of Israel gets spied on. Far from the official support of Israel that is maintained in this country, in fact, due to the fact that the Arabs have oil and Israel doesn't, and due to the close relationship between the intelligence community, the national security establishment, and petroleum producers, in fact, Israel has always been viewed with great suspicion, despite the official support. And so that is the genesis of what we're going to see as the Jew Room, one of the more striking aspects of the NSA-GCHQ liaison. But again, note that warrantless wiretapping by the NSA is literally business as usual. It has been from the get-go, so why the flap? Turning to Secret War Against the Jews. According to several of the old spies who worked in communications intelligence, the NSA headquarters is also the chief British espionage base in the United States. The presence of British wiretappers at the keyboards of American eavesdropping computers is a closely guarded secret, one that very few people in the intelligence community have been aware of, but it's true. An American historian, David Kahn, first stumbled onto a corner of the British connection in 1966 while writing his book, The Codebreakers. One indication of just how sensitive this information is considered on both sides of the Atlantic, is the fact that Kahn's publishers in New York and London were put under enormous pressure to censor a great deal of the book. In the main, Kahn simply revealed the existence of the liaison relationship, but when he wrote that the NSA and its British equivalent, the Government Communications Headquarters, quote, exchange personnel on a temporary basis, unquote, he had come too close to revealing the truth. The U.S. government told Kahn to hide the existence of British electronic spies from the American public. Kahn eventually agreed to delete a few of the most sensitive paragraphs describing the exchange of codes, techniques, and personnel with the British government. His innocuous few sentences threatened to disclose a larger truth, however. By the 1960s, the temporary, unquote, British personnel at Fort Meade had become a permanent fixture. The British enjoyed continued success to the greatest listening post in the world. The NSA is a giant vacuum cleaner. It sucks in every form of electronic information from telephone calls to telegrams across the United States. The presence of British personnel is essential for the American wiretappers to claim plausible deniability. Then Loftus and Ahrens go on to describe the specifics of how this relationship works. Continuing, here is how the game is played. The British liaison officer at Fort Meade types the target list of suspects, unquote, into the American computer. The NSA computer sorts through its wiretaps and gives the British officer the recording of any American citizen he wants. Since it is technically a British target of surveillance, no American search warrant is necessary. The British officer then simply hands the results over to his American liaison officer. Of course, the Americans provide the same service to the British in return. All international and domestic telephone calls in Great Britain are run through the NSA station in the British Government Communication Headquarters, or GCHQ, at Menwith Hill, which allows the American liaison officer to spy on any British citizen without a warrant. According to our sources, this duplicitous, reciprocal arrangement disguises the most massive and illegal domestic espionage apparatus in the world. Not even the Soviets could touch the UK-US intercept technology. Through this charade, the intelligence services of each country can claim that they are not targeting their own citizens. The targeting is done by an authorized foreign agent, the intelligence liaison resident in Britain or the United States. Thus, in 1977, during an investigation by the House Government Operations Committee, Admiral Bobby Inman could claim with a straight face that, quote, there are no U.S. citizens now targeted by the NSA in the United States or abroad. None, unquote. Since the targeting was done not by NSA, but by employees of British GCHQ, he was telling the literal truth. Still, the congressional staff knew enough at the time to characterize Inman's statement in an unpublished report as, quote, misleading, unquote. Whether Inman had personal knowledge of the British wiretapping may never be resolved. None of our sources claims to be present on any occasion when Admiral Inman met with the British liaison officers. It should be noted, however, that before Inman started his career with Naval Intelligence, he was assigned as an aide to London. The British connection may explain not only Inman's meteoric rise to become the youngest director of the NSA, but also why President Reagan later selected him to become William Casey's deputy at the CIA. The move surprised many who knew of Inman's reputation as a reformer and do-gooder. In fact, it was Admiral Inman who pulled the plug on the NSA's infamous Task Force 157 while he was at CIA. It is entirely possible that Inman may have been an innocent man whose public reputation for integrity was used for window dressing. Inman's supporters in the NSA, of whom he has many, suggest that the blame for the British wiretap connection rests entirely with the FBI, and that the NSA's job was only to carry out a targeting policy instituted by J. Edgar Hoover. That begs the question of whether Inman knew about the British targeting when he gave his misleading statement to Congress. Whether Inman had personal knowledge of the origins or extent of British domestic espionage or not, the old spies, several of whom served at Fort Meade, say that his denial of domestic targeting by the NSA is all semantic bull s blank blank blank, unquote. It is well known, even among low-ranking NSA employees, that the foreign liaison officers exchange all the targeting information anyway, including the names on the British target lists. Admiral Inman did not provide that information to Congress, although it was clearly relevant to its inquiries. According to a former special agent of the FBI, the you spy on mine, I'll spy on yours has been extended to the other Western partners, particularly Canada and Australia. We're going to continue with this analysis inside two of the program. As I mentioned at the beginning, I can't encourage listeners strongly enough to take advantage of the vast and steadily growing amount of information on the Spitfire website and on linked websites. I turn each For the Record program into a long, article-length written description. Those are available on the Spitfire website. A listener turns those into pieces for a blog sphere as well. There are also lectures available on the Spitfire website. There is a link to a website that has all of the declassified government documents about the Bush family's involvement with Nazi industry. There is a search function on the Spitfire website, links to a number of vital websites maintained by the heroic sister station, WFMU, which is not only archiving the entire For the Record series on Real Audio and MP3, but is also podcasting the For the Record series to people's iPods as well. So take advantage of those websites, and please take advantage not only of the dozen or so old anti-fascist books, more than 50 years old, that are available for download for free on compact PDF files, but also some written descriptions that I've spent a lot of time and effort on. When, for example, in the second half of the broadcast, I talk about Grover Norquist as part of a fifth column movement in the United States, gaining an understanding of the history and methodology of fascism is certainly useful, if not essential, for understanding what I'm driving at when I talk about a fifth column. So please take advantage of the Spitfire website and the linked websites as well. So also a page to click on the Spitfire website in order to support the work that I'm doing. And if you don't like what you see, there's no better way of fighting back than supporting the work that I'm doing. This concludes Side 1 of For the Record program number 541, titled Leaks. This is being recorded on February 12th of 2006. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening. Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record program number 541, titled Leaks, being recorded on February 12th of the year 2006. We're going to plunge right in and resume the discussion with what we were speaking about at the end of side one. There have been a number of disclosures, and perhaps that term belongs in quotes, about various misdeeds and or mistakes by the Bush administration vis-a-vis either the invasion of Iraq or the conduct of the war on terror. And one of the things that we were looking at is the fact that in point of fact, it appears that Watergate was the result of intelligence community subversion of Richard Nixon's presidency, because Nixon had run afoul of elements of the intelligence community in a number of different respects. Likewise, many of the damaging disclosures that are coming to light about the Bush administration are apparently deliberately being leaked by elements of the national security establishment, meaning the intelligence community, the military, and the State Department, also to a certain extent the British national security establishment. Those national security elements are very upset with George Bush, and it appears that some of these leaks are deliberate attempts at fighting back, that what we're really looking at is something of a civil war within the U.S. and to a certain extent the British national security establishment as well. The disclosures concerning the fact that George Bush had authorized the NSA to conduct warrantless wiretaps of American citizens, this has been a focal point and of a great deal of discussion, and there has been much righteous brow beating of breasts and wringing of hands. And frankly, to anyone familiar with the facts of the matter, the simple truth is that the NSA and its British intelligence counterparts at the GCHQ have been conducting warrantless wiretapping for decades. Literally, the NSA has been doing this since its inception. It is quite literally standard operating procedure. It has been for decades. The U.S. performs the same function on behalf of the British. So why are we seeing this Casablanca-type Louis Renault discussion of, we're shocked, to learn that there's gambling going on in this establishment. You're winning, sir. You know, that famous scene from Casablanca. Well, in fact, warrantless wiretapping by the NSA is literally business as usual. And by the way, the NSA aren't the only people that do this. A report by the European Parliament about the Echelon program maintained by the NSA and the British intelligence at Menwith Hill revealed that, in fact, European countries have the same capability, Germany and, in all probability, Russia as well. So this is not something that comes as great news. What is significant about the public flap concerning NSA warrantless wiretapping is the fact that this is even coming to light at all, because not only is it standard operating procedure, it sure as bloody hell didn't begin with George Bush. Rather, these leaks, not only the NSA warrantless wiretapping, but the other leaks that we are going to look at, these leaks are part of a civil war within the national security establishment and attempts by the intelligence community to fight back against the Bush administration. They're also, as we'll see later on this side, there also appears to be an attempt by some seriously guilty elements, people like Grover Norquist, at covering up their own complicity in the terrorism that has bedeviled the United States. We're going to return now to the book, The Secret War Against the Jews, subtitled How Western Espionage Betrayed the Jewish People, co-authored by the heroic John Loftus and Mark Ahrens, and we're going to resume with our discussion of the reciprocal spying programs conducted by British and American intelligence, and in the course of the remaining discussion about the NSA warrantless wiretapping, we're going to take a look at the genesis of this, which is anti-Jewish paranoia in the United States. Returning to Loftus and Aaron's account, according to a former special agent of the FBI, the you spy on mine, I'll spy on yours deal has been extended to the other Western partners, particularly Canada and Australia. The British, with the help of sophisticated NSA computers, can bug just about anyone, anywhere. The electronic search for subversives continues, particularly in the United States. The NSA conceded precisely that point when the U.S. Justice Department investigated its wiretapping of American protesters during the Vietnam War. The NSA assured the Justice Department that the information was acquired only incidentally as part of a British GCHQ collection program. The incidental, unquote, British exception has become the rule. As discussed later in this chapter, illegal electronic surveillance, particularly against American Jews, continued past the McCarthy era, all through the Cold War, and past the collapse of the Soviet Union. In modern times, commercial interests in the Middle East, rather than security considerations, have been the driving force behind the domestic bugging. Where oil is concerned, the British and American wiretappers use their anti-Jewish intelligence as an under-the-table bargaining chip to appease the Arabs. Publicly, our nations are allied with Israel. Privately, we give secret intelligence to Israel's enemies in time of war. As we discuss in Chapter 12 on the Liberty Incident, Congress does not have a clue how the British-American wiretap war works. For that matter, U.S. supervision of American wiretapping has been minimal. During the 1975 Senate Church Committee investigations, the NSA was forced to concede that, quote, there is not any statute that prohibits interception of domestic communications, unquote. In short, the wiretappers were outside the reach of any existing law. Technology had outstripped the legal protections of privacy. While insisting that its efforts were mainly directed at overseas communications, the NSA also admitted that it was, quote, technically possible, unquote, to monitor domestic conversations within the United States, quote, if some person with malintent desired to do so, unquote. Some person, like J. Edgar Hoover, for example. Hoover was one of the biggest customers of wiretap information from its inception. In fact, the FBI made no bones about its right to listen in to domestic conversations without a warrant. It wasn't until a 1975 court case that the FBI was finally told that they had no legal right to wiretap individuals or organizations without a warrant unless there was a proven agency relationship, unquote, with a foreign power. In fact, until the stricter 1975 standards, the FBI could wiretap or place surveillance on any Jew who gave money to any Jewish organization that supported Israel. Here is an example of the type of innocuous information that was forwarded to the FBI as a result of their obsessive surveillance of American Jews. Quote, Emma Lazarus Foundation of Jewish Women Clubs among larger donors contributing $500 during a fundraising dinner held by the Emergency Civil Liberties Committee on December 15, 1962 at the Americana Hotel, New York City, in celebration of the 171st anniversary of the Bill of Rights, unquote. Loftus and Ahrens go on to comment, apparently, Jews who celebrated the Bill of Rights were considered potential, if not actual, subversives. That remains FBI policy to this day. The FBI refused to accept the restrictions from an adverse 1975 court ruling and leaked its view to the media in a 1977 memo. The FBI still defended its right to spy on persons who, quote, might be, unquote, supporters of a foreign power, or even anyone in the country who, quote, might, unquote, be influenced by a foreign power. In light of the trivial intelligence haul from most of the surveillance, it was little wonder that over the years, Hoover had gone to great lengths to keep his surveillance of American Jews a secret, particularly from the Kennedy administration. Attorney General Bobby Kennedy made almost no effort to hide his desire to force Hoover out, and rumors spread that a Jew might actually step into his august shoes. Hoover and many in the upper echelons of the Bureau were absolutely outraged, and before long, an ultimately successful campaign was underway to save the master wiretapper of U.S. intelligence. The electronic surveillance of Jews picked up during the Nixon administration, but quieted down a bit after Watergate. In 1978, Congress finally passed the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance, or FIS, Act, a feeble attempt to stamp out some of the worst excesses of domestic espionage. Parenthetically, it is this act that the Bush administration is perceived as violating. In fact, basically, it never really took effect. Continuing. In another bit of lawyerly leisure domain, the FIS Act was restricted only to targeting by American agencies, leaving the British liaison officer with a major loophole. The restrictive language added to the FIS Act left unchanged the arrangement under which the British wiretapped American suspects and then passed on the information to the NSA. Inman, it should be noted, was not in the NSA during 1975-6 when the language of the British loophole was contrived, although he was its director in 1978 when the act finally became law. To this day, Congress does not realize that the British liaison officers at the NSA are still free to use American equipment to spy on American citizens. And in fact, they are doing just that. Congress has been kept in the dark deliberately. This is a fact, not a matter of conjecture or a conclusion based on anonymous sources. In the early 1980s, during the Reagan administration, one of the authors of this book submitted to the intelligence community a draft of a manuscript that briefly described the wiretap shell game and mentioned that the secrecy provisions concerning British liaison relationships with the NSA have escaped congressional knowledge. The result was an uproar. The intelligence community insisted that all passages explaining the British wiretap program had to be censored and provided a list of specific deletions. Even the simple mention of the existence of a secret agreement of which Congress was unaware was banned as classified information. In 1985, when the author was called to testify about Nazis working for U.S. intelligence before a congressional subcommittee, he asked permission to discuss certain items pertaining to electronic surveillance in executive session. Permission was denied. So much for congressional oversight. Shortly after the Clinton administration took office, the intelligence community withdrew its previous objections to publication. In fact, many of the pieces of the jigsaw already had passed into the public domain. In 1982, James Bamford published his seminal history of the NSA, The Puzzle Palace, which disclosed some of the main points of the NSA-GCHQ liaison. The National Archives had been given dozens of declassified government documents citing British intelligence as the source of its information on Jews in the United States. And finally, in 1991, a pair of British authors confirmed a portion of the espionage on American Jews. Quote, "Sometime in 1945 or 1946, a special unit, even more secret than the rest of the code-breaking agency, was set up to monitor the activities of Israeli agents and their sympathizers in the U.S. and elsewhere. The men who ran this organization held the view that because of the use made by the Israelis of sympathizers from the Jewish community, no Jew, however apparently loyal a U.S. citizen, should be permitted to work in the special unit or even be told of its existence. All reports from the unit carried the code name Gold, signifying that they were not to be shown to anyone of Jewish origin. We had them cold," unquote, recalls one former intelligence official who was cleared to see the Gold reports. Again quoting, "We knew who was shipping the arms, who was paying for them, who was being paid in this country, every illegal thing that was going on in this country. Because of politics, very little was ever done with this intelligence, but so far as I know, the National Security Agency still has a group like that buried somewhere deep," unquote. And Loftus and Ahrens go on to comment, "It does indeed. Its nickname is the Jew Room," unquote. Inside the National Security Agency is an intelligence center from which all American Jews are banned, regardless of their proven loyalty or devotion to country, just as the U.S. Navy banned Jews from electronic surveillance ships such as the USS Liberty. The Jew Room is where the United States and Britain spy on Israel and anyone who supports Israel. Its name is a misnomer, as the intelligence center has more than one room in more than one agency. As we shall see in the following chapters, it is and has been the heart of the secret war against the Jews. And later on, Loftus and Ahrens go on to note that the program became so ridiculous that Jewish children who were going to Jewish summer camps are actually the focal point of some of the intelligence collection. All of which is to say that warrantless wiretapping and things which are technically unconstitutional have been a matter of routine, and they have been from the get-go. So why are we seeing this flap? Well, that's because they're elements of the intelligence community. They're deliberately leaking information in order to fight back against the Bush administration for its abuse of the intelligence community. We're going to take a quick look at a few of those leaks right now. The LA Times, from Wednesday, January 4th of 2006, has an article by Josh Meyer, Dateline Washington, headlined, CIA gave Iran bomb plans, book says. Subtitled, the nuclear designs were intentionally flawed, but Tehran was tipped off and could have made use of them, the writer contends. It reads in part, and by the way, you're going to see reference here again to the book that Edward Alden made reference to in the first column that we read, namely the James Risen book, State of War. This article reads in part, in a clumsy effort to sabotage Iran's nuclear program, the CIA in 2004 intentionally handed Tehran some top-secret bomb designs laced with a hidden flaw that U.S. officials hoped would do many weapons made from them, according to a new book about the U.S. intelligence agency. But the Iranians were tipped to the scheme by the Russian defector hired by the CIA to deliver the plans and may have gleaned scientific information useful for designing a bomb, writes New York Times reporter James Risen in State of War, The Secret History of the CIA and the Bush Administration, unquote. The clandestine CIA effort was just one of many alleged intelligence failures during the Bush administration, according to the book. Risen also cites intelligence gaffes that fueled the Bush administration's case for war against Saddam Hussein, spawning a culture of torture throughout the U.S. military and encouraged the rise of heroin cultivation and trafficking in post-war Afghanistan. Even before the book's release Tuesday, its main revelation that President Bush authorized a secret effort by another intelligence outfit, the National Security Agency, to eavesdrop on unsuspecting Americans without court-approved warrants, had created a storm of controversy when it was reported last month in the New York Times in an article co-authored by Risen. Well, again, this stuff has been going on since the day one. So, again, why the sudden outrage? That's because these leaks are part of something that really approximates a civil war within the intelligence community. Skipping down. According to the book, the CIA effort to sabotage Iran's nuclear effort came on the heels of another massive intelligence failure in which a CIA officer mistakenly sent an Iranian agent a trove of information that could help identify nearly every one of the spy agency's undercover operatives in Iran. The Iranian was a double agent who turned over the data to Iranian authorities. They used it to dismantle the CIA's spy network inside the country and arrest or possibly kill an unknown number of U.S. agents, the book says. So again, the new James Risen book filled with information about missteps by the Bush administration, these leaks apparently being done to deliberately undermine the Bush against something of a civil war. Yet another leak coming from the intelligence community. New York Times, February 11, 2006. Article by Scott Shane, Dateline, Washington, headline, ex-CIA official says Iraq data was distorted. One of a number of disclosures about the fudging of intelligence. This article reads in part, a CIA veteran who oversaw intelligence assessments about the Middle East from 2000 to 2005 on Friday accused the Bush administration of ignoring or distorting the pre-war evidence on a broad range of issues related to Iraq in its effort to justify the American invasion of 2003. The views of Paul R. Pillar, who retired in October as National Intelligence Officer for the Near East and South Asia, echoed previous criticism from Democrats and from some administration officials, including Richard A. Clark, the former White House counterterrorism advisor, and Paul H. O'Neill, a former Treasury Secretary. But Mr. Pillar is the first high-level CIA insider to speak out by name on the use of pre-war intelligence. His article for the March-April issue of Foreign Affairs, which charges the administration with the selective use of intelligence about Iraq's unconventional weapons and the chances of post-war chaos in Iraq, was posted Friday on the journal's website after it was first reported in the American Post. As the Downing Street memo indicates, there are elements within the British national security establishment that are also conducting a deliberate leaking campaign, so to speak, sort of turning this into sort of a an Anglo-Saxon national security civil war. Article from the Los Angeles Times from February 11th of 2006, a new book out in Britain, supplements the Downing Street memo. This article is titled, Book Casts Doubt on Case for War. It's by John Danisewski of the LA Times. Again, dated February 11th of 06, Dateline London. It reads in part, it was the end of January of 2003. Secretary of State Colin Powell was 5 days away from giving a critical speech at the UN Security Council, laying out the case that Iraq was hiding weapons of mass destruction and posed a danger to world peace. But huddled with aides at the White House, President Bush and British Prime Minister Tony Blair were not sure there was enough evidence to convince the Security Council. Without the Council's explicit authorization, their plans for an invasion to depose Saddam Hussein could be difficult to defend under international law. Bush proposed an alternative. Paint a U.S. spy plane in United Nations colors and see if that didn't tempt Hussein's forces to shoot at it. In any case, he said, the war was penciled in, unquote, for March 10th, and the United States would go ahead with or without a second U.N. resolution. Blair replied that he was solidly with, unquote, the president. This is the gist of an account of the January 31st, 2003 meeting contained in the new edition of Lawless World, a book by British author Philippe Sands. He has not identified the writer of the memorandum on which the account is based, but British media reports say it was one of the aides in attendance, Sir David Manning, then security advisor to Blair and now the British ambassador in Washington. So again, in addition to the Downing Street memo, that leak coming out as well. Yet another intelligence leak, creating a very accurately unflattering picture of the Bush administration's conduct of this particular war. An article from the Financial Times of Wednesday, January 4th of 2006. This is an article by Peter Spiegel. It's headlined, Ex-CIA Agent Says U.S. Missed Bin Laden in Afghan Battle. This article reads in part of yet, and this, by the way, talks about yet another intelligence failure, the escape of Bin Laden from Tora Bora. It reads in part, U.S. military commanders were told that Osama bin Laden was hiding in the mountainous Tora Bora region of Afghanistan in early December of 2001, but failed to send troops to block his escape, according to a new account by the CIA officer who ran the agency's operations in the country. Gary Burnson, a CIA veteran who headed a paramilitary team called Jawbreaker during the Afghan War, said in a book published last week that one of his Arab-speaking operatives found a radio on a dead al-Qaeda fighter during the Tora Bora battle and heard the terrorist leader repeatedly trying to rally his troops. Quote, after the Spectre gunship aircraft cleared the area, Bilal heard a voice he recognized from dozens of tape recordings, Mr. Burnson wrote, using a pseudonym for an Arab-American former Marine who was part of the CIA team. Quote, it was Osama bin Laden telling his troops to keep fighting, unquote. Later on the same captured radio, Bilal and a second CIA agent, another American of Middle Eastern origin, reported hearing Mr. bin Laden apologizing for getting his men trapped in the mountains and killed in large numbers by American bombing, Mr. Burnson wrote. The book titled Jawbreaker was heavily edited by CIA censors. Note that this part did make it out from the editorial process, almost certainly once again an attempt at embarrassing the Bush administration. Mr. Burnson also wrote that on the recommendation of a former Special Forces officer who was part of his team as a CIA contractor, he made a formal request to have 800 U.S. Army Rangers deployed along the Pakistani border to prevent Mr. bin Laden's escape, a request that was never granted. The issue of whether U.S. commanders failed to capture Mr. bin Laden at Tora Bora because of an over-reliance on unreliable Afghan warlords became an issue in the 2004 presidential campaign when Democratic challenger John Kerry accused the Bush administration of allowing the al-Qaeda leader to escape by not sending American troops to the battlefield. At the time, retired General Tommy Franks, the former head of U.S. Central Command who ran the Afghan campaign, denied that the military knew of Mr. bin Laden's presence and accused Mr. Kerry of relying on, quote, distortions of history, unquote. Well, apparently that was not the case. Now, another key factor vis-a-vis the wiretap scandal, and that concerns the fact that none other than Grover Norquist, arguably the linchpin of the GOP right, has suddenly become terribly concerned with civil liberties, and he has joined with what is, to a certain extent at least, a liberal coalition in order to inveigh against this warrantless wiretapping. San Francisco Chronicle, Thursday, January 26th of 2006, article by James Sterngold, its headline, Political Opposites Aligned Against Bush Wiretaps, and this concerns Grover Norquist. Grover Norquist is one of the most influential conservative Republicans in Washington. His weekly Wednesday meeting at his L Street office is a must for conservative strategists, and he has been called the managing director of the hardcore right by the Liberal Nation magazine. Perhaps the nation's leading anti-tax enthusiast, he is, like Diamond, a hawk in the war on terror. Yes, he is a hawk on the war on terror, but as we have seen in many broadcasts, Grover Norquist is in fact the lobbyist for some of the most heinous terrorists and terror-linked elements in the country. His Islamic Institute, part of the GOP's ethnic outreach organization, was basically a repository for Al-Taqwa, Hamas, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, and Al-Qaeda-related elements, and Norquist was the personal lobbyist for many of these people. In a number of broadcasts that will be cited in the description, for the record, 541, some of Norquist's heinous representation of the very terrorists the Bush administration professes to be against will be discussed at some length. And by the way, the Norquist cloud has not been raised from the national security establishment. Again, I think that Norquist's concern, as he says, he's worried that Hillary Clinton or somebody like her could eventually come into this information. If the truth were ever to fully be disclosed, it would reveal that Grover Norquist and his ilk are in fact running interference for the very terrorists that are our enemy in this war. Something that has unfortunately escaped a lot of people's notice. But the Norquist name is still very much part of the struggle. Following article with which we'll close the program comes from Salon.com. Guess who the new chief financial officer is for the Department of Homeland Security? It's Grover Norquist's kid brother, David Norquist. This article by Tim Grieve, the best person he could find? We don't have any doubt that George Bush will pick the best person, unquote, he can find to serve as the new chief financial officer for the Department of Homeland Security. And if that best person just happens to be the brother of an informal advisor to the president who has been implicated in the Jack Abramoff scandal, well, life is full of funny coincidences. With the tip of the war room helmet to Josh Marshall, we note word that the president plans to name David L. Norquist as the new CFO for DHS. As UPI reports, Norquist is the younger brother of Grover Norquist, the anti-tax crusader who would like to see the federal government shrunk down so small you could drown it in a bathtub just as soon as he and Abramoff are done profiting from it. Well, again, I suspect that Grover Norquist's concern over wiretapping concerns some of the things that he must have been saying to his numerous terrorist clients, because Grover Norquist, the Islamic Institute, and people like Sami Alarian, Abdurrahman Alamoudi, and others constitute the direct link between the GOP and its ethnic outreach organization and some of the most heinous terrorists that, in theory at least, the Bush administration is supposed to be fighting. We can all rest easy knowing that Grover Norquist's kid brother is going to be managing the finances for the Department of Homeland Security. Phew, that is a relief. Please do take advantage of the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com and the many, many linked websites, a vast treasure trove of written material. And again, within a couple of weeks of the airing of this broadcast, there will be a long article-length written description of For the Record Program 541. Do take advantage of the Spitfire website and linked websites, a vast and growing amount of both printed and audio information to supplement these broadcasts. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record Program number 541, titled Leaks, being recorded on February 12th of the year 2006. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.